Welcome to our 6th annual Oscar nomination reaction special. I am Cinema Joe's host, Alex Marcus, and when I am not here talking with you today about film, I am the podcast editor for PopBreak.com. Today, I am joined by my co-host and Podwork Angels, a Rush Hour podcast host, Justin Mancini. How's Oscar season treating you this year, Justin?
It's okay. We'll get into it.
I'm sure we will. Sadly, our other co-host, Noah France, is, and I kid you not, too busy vacationing in Zanzibar to join us today. But I'm happy to say we are, for the fourth time in a row, joined by our favorite Oscar prognosticator and film editor for thepodprick.com, Marissa Carpico. Welcome back to the pod, Marissa.
Hi there. Man, I wish I was in Zanzibar.
Yeah, the pictures are spectacular. I had no idea it was as beautiful as it is. We're going to be getting into all of our thoughts on the major Oscar storyline this season, as this is our Oscar nomination special, including some pleasant surprises, snubs, and the state of the Best Picture race, along with a few bold predictions. But first, I like to start these shows off with a brief look back at what we had to say on last year's Oscar nomination special, back before all the races were crystallized and everything felt like a foregone conclusion. There's a couple of things that I noted from listening back to that episode. One of them was the fact that, Justin, you had missed most of the Oscar movies because you stated that yes. You were too busy acting in community theater that fall. So, Justin, did you ever get around to watching all of the Oscar movies?
I absolutely did. I think I had watched all of them before the Oscar ceremony. So I definitely made that a priority after the nominations came out.
Well, that's good. We also, one of the biggest things that we noted last year was that we were all very happy by the diversity of stories, genres, and tones represented in the nominees. And I, not to preview what we're going to talk about in a minute, but I do think that that trend is continuing, which is pretty cool to see. Another thing that we talked about was COVID. We talked about the fact that we were upset to have to keep talking about COVID. And the biggest story out of COVID that year, as it was related to award season, was how streamers were emerging as a new dominant force in Hollywood, which is just wild to hear because 1 year later, streamers got way fewer nominations in the Academy total. And also they just had a complete a bad year in the press, as it were, as Netflix hit a ceiling and everyone else panicked. So it's what a difference a year makes when it comes to the dominant force that is streaming culture in Hollywood. We also were in search of a villain of Oscar season last year, as we like to wonder, like, which is the movie or actor or actress that or director that we're going to be rooting against winning. That seems inevitable. A lot of us thought that Don't Look Up might end up getting that status. But it turned out we had to wait all the way until Oscar night to find the true villain of the season. And that was, of course, Will Smith.
Oh, boy.
Who could have predicted? Speaking of predictions, Marissa noted that if Kristen Stewart loses on Oscar night, she would, and I quote, enter into stages of grief that would take months to get over, possibly years. So I just want to check in with you, Marissa. How are you holding up after Kristen Stewart lost?
You know, every day is a struggle, but we're going to get through it, her and I think. It was devastating, but, you know, we survive, and she will act again and probably, you know, get another nomination at some point, we hope.
Absolutely. She at least made up for it by looking incredible on Oscar night. She was one of the people that everyone was talking about in that respect. So, you know, she showed them what they missed. Now, we also talked at length about Lady Gaga being the winner of the most try-hard Oscar campaign of all time for The House of Gucci. And I just, listening back, I just kept thinking, like, wow, we had no idea Austin Butler was coming.
Oh, wow. Yeah. I mean, you know, well, there was no one. Well, I guess there was a soul for Gaga to channel back then, but that soul was still on this plane of existence, so it was pulling focus.
It's
you know,
true.
Austin Butler can just fully embody Elvis despite being from like Van Nuys or wherever.
Yeah, I believe that Lady Gaga repeatedly claimed that she was being haunted by the soul of the person who she was portraying. So I guess that is not as intense as being completely possessed by the soul of Elvis Presley. Now, we were also very happy to see more international films getting into a lot of categories, which is a trend that definitely continued. And last, you know, it's notable that none of us saw Coda winning, but I will give Justin a little bit of credit because he was correct to identify that The Power of the Dog might be vulnerable to a far more likable, warm-hearted family drama. He thought that family drama would be Belfast. And Marissa, you agreed. You thought that that had that was a pretty good argument. But it's really interesting that we like Coda was not even on our radar at that point. It's really wild to look back and think like that Best Picture race just completely exploded and upended in such a short amount of time during the time between the nominations being announced and when the actual thing hit.
I mean, it's a testament to how quickly Oscar narratives can change once the season is really, you know, in high gear.
Yeah, it really felt like it was just a situation where everybody was just hadn't actually seen that movie and watched it last, and everybody felt such good feelings. They were like, let's make this be the Best Picture winner. And now I feel most people don't even remember that that happened. They only remember one thing about the Oscars, and it sadly had nothing to do with any of the winners. Well, I guess it had to do with one of the winners, but not for winning.
Also, it was just like a very successful tour of like the cast of that movie, which I think we're seeing is a very common trend, especially in recent Best Picture winners. And I don't know, we may be, not to foreshadow too much, but we may be seeing more of that come this season. So.
Yeah, that is definitely true. Now, the last thing I wanted to note is that Marissa said, and I quote, "I would love to see some surprises, not horrible surprises." Now, we did get one obviously horrible surprise that no one could have anticipated, which was the thing that I've been alluding to, which is Will Smith slapping Chris Rock live on stage. But aside from that, Marissa, do you feel like there were other fun surprises at the night that like helped you balance out the absurdity that was the ending?
Interesting question. I mean, I only remember the trauma of it at this point. Do you know what I mean? I feel like there were probably some nice things, but I remember the show being a chaotic sort of production mess, number one. And then that happened. And the mood in the room, both in the audience and at home, changed so significantly that I don't know if it ever recovered, honestly.
Yeah. Well, and then it just because not only did that happen, but then not long after, Will Smith had to give his speech accepting his award, where he just has kind of a full nervous breakdown on in front of millions of people. So it was just a wild thing where, you know, I mean, I, for one, will never forget Flash entering the Speed Force. But aside from that, I suppose all of our Oscar memories are going to be stuck on Will Smith.
Would that have been your vote for best movie moment or whatever?
The movie from the director's cut that only aired on HBO Max. Yes, that was obviously my favorite cinematic moment of all time.
And you were not alone, apparently.
Oh, man. What a completely colossal disaster of an Oscars that was. We had no idea what we had in front of us.
Right. It was like year, we were all like, it'll be terrible. And then it was worse, which is really... almost you have to compliment it for being worse than you imagined.
Yeah, it's especially coming off of the heels of, you know, the previous Oscars, which we all kind of talked about at the time of being, well, that Steven Soderbergh tried a lot of things and it mostly pissed people off and it didn't really work out. And then we all ended with feeling bummed out about the Best Actor winner. And then it's like, well, cut to a year later and they tried a bunch of stuff, mostly didn't work out, and we all ended up being bummed out about the Best Actor winner. So let's see if we get 3 for 3 on that trend this year. But that was last year's Oscars. They are officially in the rear view, thank goodness. So it's time to jump into the race for this year. And we're going to get to our surprises and our subs and predictions soon. But Marissa, I'm curious what your first impressions of this year's nominees are as a whole. Was this, relatively speaking, a good year for Oscar?
Honestly, no. Well, in terms of the actual nominations, I think I was a little more surprised and interested than I thought I was going to be pre-nominations. But as a whole, I think the year is a little weak. You know, at this point, because we have an older podcast, another podcast about the older Oscar years, I sort of think about like years, like each year is a sort of like catalog of things you can watch to get a sort of temperature of the culture at the time. And this one just feels kind of all over the place and maybe like one or two solid hits, but I don't know. It's kind of, it feels like another year of also-rans. And like, I feel like I keep having this feeling because of the COVID of it all and the way it changed the industry and the way that sometimes it was just, you know, studios clearing their back catalog or something. Like, it feels like we're finally getting back into the pre-COVID film culture that we had before, but I don't know, maybe not quite. And maybe just the what's being put into production is a little, I don't know. I mean, we all experienced a collective trauma. I think that might be bearing out in the way that we're expressing art at this point.
Yeah, I think that that's very well said. It really is striking to me how, you know, obviously 2020 was a year that hit the film industry especially hard. Very few films were released compared to their normal schedule. And then 2021 came around and we thought, okay, well, we're going to get all of the movies from 2020 and then we're going to get a bunch of movies from 2021. It's going to be a stacked year, like overloaded with opportunity. And that turned out to very much not be the case. And then we thought, okay, well, but 2022 is going to be the year then when we get back to normal when it comes to releases of films. And that also turned out to not really be the case. It seems like we're still kind of slowly crawling our way out of this slowdown that happened 3 years ago at this point now. But that being said, I do think that this year's race has a lot of interesting facets to it, especially the fact that, you know, I feel like this Best Picture field and the associated nominees are interestingly covering the full year of movies, which often is not the case, right? Like, we have films that were released across six, I think, out of the 12 months of the year, which almost never happens. It's usually a couple, like maybe one or two movies from earlier in the year and then everything else from November and December. And I think that that is cool because it really gives us that feeling of, you know, of getting to see the year in film represented by Oscars. And that feels something that we don't often get. And also it's nice to see so many first time nominees. It really feels like this could be one of those like changing of the guard moments at the Oscars where we're really getting a sense of, okay, this is where the film industry is headed. This is where we're moving to. And that's always a nice thing to see. So for me, there's kind of like a nice balance between the sort of like trying to figure out like why so few movies came out this year, but then also feeling like, you know, they actually kind of awarded a lot of the movies that, or at least nominated a lot of the movies that I would have wanted them to. So that's an unusual feeling to have. But Justin, what do you think?
I'll echo what you said. Like, for me, it's a very mixed bag. As I mentioned before, there's a lot of things I like and a lot of things that I was not just surprised, like that I felt deserved to be here, but also was like fairly certain they were like, if not locks, then at least like had a really good chance of getting on here. And I agree with you. I think there are a lot of good first time nominees and I was really happy to see that. I won't go into specifics because that might come up later. But, you know, I'm thinking especially of actors who I think have always been kind of like character actors who are now finally getting attention, even though it feels like, you know, for years they've been great. So I really like that aspect of it. I also did not realize just how much momentum Everything Everywhere All at Once had until I saw how many nominations this movie has racked up. You've got like the I think as I've kind of alluded to before, you got the cast like just like really like charming people. And I think that's been like a huge part of why they've had so much momentum, even though, you know, it is one of those movies that came out earlier in the year. So it's really crazy that not just that a movie from earlier in the year is like one of the front runners, but also the movie itself is not a typical Oscar movie. So I think there is a lot of positive stuff here. I was surprised to see so much love for Triangle of Sadness, which is not one of my favorite movies of the year. I know that it's, you know, it seems to have gotten like a lot of acclaim, especially within Hollywood itself. And it is somewhat of an outsider. Like it has Ruben Östlund as the director who, you know, is Swedish. He's not like, he's an Academy member now, but he's not like necessarily, he's not necessarily like part of the you know part of the old guard. But I was surprised to see how many nominations it got. That was definitely a surprise for me. And I would also say
that was okay. One that was really interesting to me because I thought, you know, there was a lot of buzz early in the season about Triangle of Sadness and how, oh, this is going to really appeal to Academy voters. This is the sort of like class satire that really appeals to their ego in a way that they're going to really enjoy. And you know, Ausland has been this guy who has been knocking at the door ever since Force Majeure, and has obviously he's won two awards at Cannes, so he's internationally respected. And there's a lot of kind of narrative around, oh, this is going to be the one that breaks through. And then it really seemed like that was petering out as more people did more movies. And I too was really shocked that ended up coming together in the end, and he secured the best director nomination. The best picture.
Right. And I would also just say, like, there were a couple of films that seemed to have a lot of momentum early on and then were losing it. And I was like, actually kind of thankful for it, because I was like, oh, great. This means I don't have to, like, you know, I don't have to watch them to feel like I'm a, you know, a completist for the year. And then they got like one nomination. I'm thinking of films like Bardo and Blonde, where I'd be like, oh, they got a nomination. I guess I don't have to watch them. no one's paying me to do it. But at the same time, I'm like, but also I like still want to like at least have it like in my vocabulary, like when I'm talking about the Oscars in general. So I'm like, okay, I guess I'm watching Bardo and I guess I'm watching Blonde and I'm doing it under protest, but I'm going to do it. So there were a couple of those too. So yeah, mixed bag for me.
Marissa, do you think that Justin should have to watch Blonde?
I mean, I haven't watched Blonde at this point, and I am very pissed that I do now have to watch it. So I don't think so. Like, I have a podcast about it, and I have to do an episode about the actress category. So it's like, it's the only reason I'm watching it. I would have avoided it completely, because it seems like, you know, something that one has to endure rather than has the possibility of enjoying. But yeah, I echo that sentiment, because there were so many that I was like, are you kidding me? I have to watch this. Like, I actually spent the day before we are recording this going to three different theaters in Manhattan to see three different movies that were nominated, which is just a hellish nightmare to me. I mean, within 24 hours, I'd actually gone to four different theaters.
That sounds like my best Saturday afternoon ever. So I can't say that I could agree with you on that being a hellish nightmare.
I think it would have been fine if I were at one theater and I didn't have to pay for two of those tickets, but or three of the tickets in the 24 hour four movie marathon. But I literally had to time it so that I could bike between three different theaters, and I had like 20 minutes between each movie, so I didn't eat for 9 hours.
So you're saying
biking certainly makes things worse.
Yes, it's like me locking up doing the stuff. It was terrible. It was really bad.
So just your own Triangle of Sadness then.
Deeply, yes, correct, actually.
Triangle of Sadness, I think, also could be the subtitle of Blonde, correct? Based on what I've heard.
Oh, no.
Probably.
Depending on Carol's favorite acting performance, as it turns out.
Wait, whose?
If you... Colin Farrell, if you remember from the Globes when he won his award, he complimented Ana de Armas.
I did not watch the Globes. I apologize to the Globes.
I didn't watch the Globes either, but I did watch some of the victory speeches after the fact. Because, you know, why sit through a 3 hour long award show when you can watch it in 20 minutes? But yeah, in Colin Farrell's victory, I guess Ana de Armas was the one who gave the award to Colin Farrell. Just by happenstance, and he specifically like turned to her on stage and specifically complimented her performance and said it moved him to tears, and everyone laughed in the theater, and he was like, well, you can laugh if you want, but I'm being serious. And it was kind of a crazy moment. So it was a harbinger of things to come from the Academy, it turns out, with Blonde at least. But speaking of harbingers of things to come, another movie that did really well this year was All Quiet on the Western Front, which turned out to be Netflix's unexpected top contender at the awards, got the second most nominations of any film. And this is a German remake of the classic film from way back in the day. Very, very surprising news, I think. And I'm curious, Marissa, is this, I know Justin has seen this. Marissa, have you seen this yet?
I have. I was going to review it, actually, because I got a screener from Netflix. But then in fairly quick succession, the election happened and I got COVID. So I just never had time to do so. But I was a little surprised by the nominate. Well, not just the nomination for, you know, one or two things, but so many nominations for it, because it felt like that movie came out and then no one talked about it. So I just assumed it wasn't going to be in the conversation, when prior to that, I assumed it would be in the conversation a lot. But yeah, I was genuinely shocked by how many nominations it got on, you know, nomination morning, as it were.
Yeah, and like, it's certainly a movie that you could see racking up technical nominations in a way that can help like pad its stats. But it seems like it was just a broadly popular film across all of the branches, which then also makes me wonder, like, well, if it's this popular, why did it not get a director nomination? Like, how did he lose that to Ausland in that slot that was clearly going towards an international director, which has been the trend recently? Justin, do you have any thoughts on this? I know that you thought that this was I think you gave it like three and a half stars on Letterboxd, so maybe not your favorite movie of the year. Were you surprised to see it doing so well and yet missing Best Director?
Yeah, I definitely had those thoughts. I guess having seen the movie, it does make sense to me to some extent, because it really feels like, I just think the Academy likes a really well-made war movie still. Like, I think that's still a big part of what they like, and this film definitely gives that to you. It is much more horrifying, I think, than some previous war movies that have been nominated. And I think that is, for me, the best aspect of it. And I have to say, as a fan of the 1930 Best Picture winning All Quiet on the Western Front, I would say, like, this kind of, at least in terms of those scenes, I think kind of like it holds its own. Like, it's certainly very impressive, not just from a technical standpoint, but like from an emotional one too. I think it really does put you in the trenches, and I think that, you know, I think that the Academy really responded to that. It's more of the other aspects outside of that where I maybe am not as big a fan of the movie. I there's a whole subplot with Daniel Brühl, who's trying to negotiate the end of the war, which didn't quite work for me. But so this is a year for me where some of the international releases, I feel like I'm kind of like, I wish, like, did it have to go to these movies especially? Like, there's no, like, you know, I don't, you know, like, it was really nice to have something like Drive My Car as a front runner, which I genuinely believe was like one of the best movies of the year. And here I'm kind of like, okay, I can see why this is what appeals to the Academy, but I really don't feel like it's maybe the best reflection of international film, especially in a year where something like Decision to Leave got totally left out. So yeah, I was surprised, but also it is tough when you've got, I think, those five slots. And I don't know. I just guess there was that last surge for Triangle of Sadness, where Berger from All Quiet on the Western Front got blanked out.
Yeah. Speaking of Decision to Leave, it's really interesting to me that this year is being rightfully lauded as one of the most, like, historically notable years for Asian people in Hollywood, being awarded at the Oscars, thanks to its multiple, the Asian actors being nominated in multiple categories. And, you know, we have Daniel Kwan being nominated for Best Director. But yet, you know, one of the best films to come out of Asia this year, Decision to Leave, completely overlooked in all categories, including international, and RRR, which was not eligible for international feature, but made a really big push for all major categories, including Best Picture, including getting a viral endorsement from James Cameron, of all people, just completely missed outside of that original song nominee, which seems like they're probably going to win that category. But, you know, that's definitely underwhelming from what their initial hopes were, based on how wildly successful that film was internationally, and how many people seemed to just really, really enjoy the experience of seeing that film in a theater. So I'm curious, Marissa, like, how do you make sense of all of this? Like, the on one hand, you know, such a historic day for Asian actors and creators in the film industry, and yet, you know, two of the biggest ticket films out of Asia, like, just completely missed.
I mean, I think it's a testament to the fact that the, like, we've gotten lucky over the past couple of years, right? There have been these international pictures that have either won Best Picture, like Parasite, or been very lauded by the awards. But you have to remember that the Oscars were created for the Hollywood studio system to award itself, right? So any entry of something from without that system, with outside that system, is a huge achievement. Like RRR getting a nomination at all is huge, even if it's just for a song. And realistically, they're going to perform the hell out of that song on stage, assuming there are still performances of songs at the ceremony. And so many people will see it. And realistically, it'll be something that opens up the door for more films from the Indian market to make it into our market and become more and more recognized. So, you know, I think it's great for, I mean, as a Filipino person, I'm thrilled. There are a lot of like Southeast Asian and like Pacific Islanders representation going on, right? And like Everything Everywhere All at Once is getting more attention. It's about a slow progression with the Oscars. It can never be one year and then all of it's fixed. It's just going to be work. We're just going to have to work with it for like 10 years at least from now on. You know what I mean? Every year it's going to get a little better, a little more diverse as the Academy itself gets more diverse. So, you know, I'm happy for what we got. I'm thrilled RRR really got anything at all. Honestly, I was hoping for more, but, you know, realistically that was a heavy lift.
Yeah, it's understandable. I mean, I saw so many people predicting that it was going to get a Best Picture nomination, and that just always, for the reasons that you described, felt like a real long shot to me. So I am glad that they're going to have a presence on the stage, and I can't wait to see what that performance is going to be like. I hope they do like what Beyonce did a couple years ago, where they just like don't even bother to try to stage it in the theater itself, and just like, you know, take over an entire street someplace, or maybe an entire basketball stadium or something, just to have like the epic scale that song requires. But it's gonna be bananas in a really fun way.
I hope that performance knocks our heads off, you know what I mean?
Yeah, the Oscars for a couple of years, not recently, but within the last 10 years, they've done this a couple of times. They've opened with a song, with one of the big musical numbers, to kind of like get the energy up. And I really hope that that's what they do with this song here. I hope that they just open up the Oscars with it. That would be kind of wild, because it's, you know, of course, it's not an English language song, and that might be really disorienting to, you know, middle America. But what better way to get everybody's like juices flowing and blood pumping than having that song opening up the Oscars?
Yeah, from your mouth to the producer's ears.
Justin, what do you think about this discussion?
Oh, well, it's funny because I'm picturing that now, and then I'm like, is there going to be like a competition to see who's going to like be able to keep dancing the longest, and we'll just never get to the award ceremony, which actually might be a better ceremony. I don't know. I mean,
yeah, you could totally see it, like them just pulling random celebrities onto the stage to make them dance, like getting Hugh Jackman up there. I mean, yeah. Who wouldn't want to see that?
Yeah.
okay, well, we've had fun talking about a lot of the more, you know, the good and the bad, but now we're here to talk about the ugly, which is unfortunately the Two Leslie controversy fiasco that has hit the Oscars in shocking succession. This, for people who haven't been following this, fantastic character actress Andrea Riseborough, who everyone loves if you know who she is, and you probably love her even if you don't know who she is, because she is one of those character actresses that just kind of melt into their parts, and you're oftentimes not necessarily noticing that's who it is from movie to movie, but you're always really getting a powerful impact from her performance. She was in this film, very, very small indie, called Two Leslie, which is about a woman overcoming alcohol and substance abuse. And in the week of Oscar voting, there was this quote unquote grassroots movement where Mary McCormick, who I am a fan of from her time in really trying to save the last couple seasons of the West Wing way back in the day. she's married to the director of this film. She kind of pushed really hard along with the publicist from this movie to get all of her friends who are famous to talk to her other friends who are famous and to just really get out there on social media publicizing how great Andrea Riseborough is and making this concerted effort to get 200 people to list her as their number one actor in the best lead actress race, because they realized that if you get 200 people to vote for her in first place, she's going to get into the category no matter what. And much easier to wrangle 200 as opposed to the like several hundred, if not thousands, of actors in the acting branch to consider her. So that was kind of the big push that they did. We got a lot of headlines for kind of coming out of nowhere and doing this quote unquote grassroots movement that really upended people's expectations and shifted the way campaigns were being done in Hollywood, or at least people were wondering if this could shift things in the future. Unfortunately, she ended up, along with Ana de Armas, who was also a little bit of a surprise nominee, although Anna did pop up in Globes and SAG, so it wasn't a huge shock that she got there. But they ended up pushing out Viola Davis for The Woman King and Daniel Detweiler for Till. Daniel Detweiler especially was considered kind of a lock for this category. Viola Davis was a little bit more in the bubble, but both of them end up missing because of this. Huge kind of backlash forms. Now we hear that there is going to be an investigation over possible unethical campaigning that's going to be presented to the board this coming week as we're recording, which could end up jeopardizing Andrea Riseborough's nomination, although probably not. But it's really ambiguous. Marissa, as a lifelong historian of Oscar campaigns at this point, I'm really curious to get your take on what the hell happened, if you think that this is something that requires disciplinary action, if this is something that you're, you know, happy to see as a fan of Andrea Riseborough, or maybe upset to see as a fan of Andrea Riseborough, given that this is now going to be a permanent kind of scar on her legacy, question mark. I'm just really curious where you're at with all of this.
I mean, I love Andrea Riseborough. If you'd asked me what movie she could possibly be nominated for last year, I wouldn't have even known this existed. But she, to Leslie, I mean, but I like her a lot. So her pulling in favors, because there's discussion that she funded this sort of campaign with her own money, realistically, and her manager, you know, helped do it. And that man should like win an award at this point for like basically moneyballing the Oscars, or like, you know, 548-ing it or whatever. It's like, I don't know. It's fascinating to me that somehow they figured out the math and they gamed the system. And I think that's really the reason for the possible disciplinary action and the investigation, because, like I said, this is really about letting Hollywood power players award themselves. And what she did was break the system by showing that you don't have to do this very expensive campaigning over months and months and years, possibly. All you really need to do is call in the right favors at the right time. And that's what happened here. And I think part of what the Academy is trying to actively like show that they're actively working on this war is because it exposes what the Oscars are, which are really political in a way that, you know, people have always not liked about the Oscars. It's the Oscars, we'd like to think, are a showcase of the best movies of a year, but that's not really true. This is about how you play the game. Every actor and actress or a person involved in a film or whatever has to campaign, and mostly it's done behind the scenes. There are dinners, there are you know, little screenings that go on, sometimes hosted by Charlize Theron for To Leslie, where she's very passionate about this movie no one's heard of, or Gwyneth Paltrow. A lot of times you're not seeing that. This is exposing that culture, realistically. And of course it would make people angry because it makes it very clear that, like, realistically, this is all just a big game. And I've, you know, as someone who is so involved in the Oscar sort of conversation, I am interested in that. And, like, as a sort of numbers voting person, I think this whole thing is so much fun, but I can see why people would be angry. But also, you know, this is the nature of the Oscars, unfortunately, that a great performance like Daniel Deadwyler's and Till, and honestly, Till itself is a better movie than a lot of the movies that are in the conversation realistically. And yet, because it have this sort of outsider narrative in its own way, it's just not getting the attention that it should. You know, Viola and Woman King are different, obviously, but that has a high hill to climb anyway, because it's an action picture. It's about Black women, which, you know, historically, the Oscars don't care about. So I don't know. I mean, I think it's unfortunate that a lot of these very good performances got overlooked. But I think to focus on specifically that the To Leslie campaign as the sort of, like, villain of it all, I think is misguided. I mean, the thing is, the Oscars themselves and the way they are set up are always the real villain here. When we can't lose sight of that.
Yeah. And to add a little bit more specificity to the ethics concerns that have been risen, it seems that there's concern that the strategy that they used was maybe too forceful in trying to recruit those celebrity endorsers, that maybe that they were kind of they rode the line between harassing and just forcefully requesting. It seems to me, based on what I've seen, that it was pretty much on the right side of that line, but I could see how it is on the line, and people maybe being concerned about slippery slopes of, if you let this happen, then it's going to get worse in the future. But, like, I always am hesitant to endorse slippery slope arguments, because it's like, we'll deal with the problem once it gets down the slippery slope, right? And then there's also the question of, like, some of the one of the big prohibitions in Oscar campaigning is you're not supposed to name your competitor in any way, because it could be perceived as derogatory, even if it's only by implication. And there are instances where it seems like that did occur in terms of naming, like, you know, Frances Fisher, for instance, had some posts online saying, you know, all of the other ladies that we love, Cate Blanchett and Michelle Yeoh and Danielle and Viola, they're all safe, so you don't have to worry about voting for them. So vote for Leslie, vote for Andrea and To Leslie, I should say. And that, again, it's like, yeah, it seems like that is technically maybe not allowed, but not exactly the same thing as campaigning negatively against people actively. So it really feels like people kind of pulling to try to make this seem like something that requires disciplinary action, where it's at the very least really on the line of appropriate versus inappropriate. But Justin, I want to get you in on this. What do you think about all of this? Kind of, I haven't really talked to you about this at all yet, so I have no idea where you're at with this.
I mean, gosh, you know, it was one of those things I had heard, but before the nominations, I had heard about this push for that movie. So I remember when I actually ended up watching the announcement of the nominations, when they said it, I had this, like, gut reaction of, like, what is that? What? And then I was like, oh, I remember now. Okay. So I don't know. I wonder if that was, like, other people. I feel like that was people in the room, like, what their reaction was to that.
Well, I believe there were audible gasps in the room when it happened.
Yes. I'm very happy to hear Marissa's take on this, because it was kind of confirming a lot of what I was like, isn't this like what the studios are doing, but it's like on a smaller scale, so that makes it not okay. I don't know. It really is a case of, like, saying the quiet part out loud, I think, and making it, like, you know, just making people aware of how this whole process works. And I think it's because it's a lot more obvious what's happening in this case that it has riled up more people. And, you know, I love, you know, I think I've said on this podcast how much I love Andrea Riseborough. She's, like, in my opinion, like, one of the best actors working today, a true chameleon, which is not something I could say about most actors. And I'm unhappy that it seems like part of her reputation might be damaged by this. At the same time, I think the other thing that is getting talked about, and this may lead to more reform within the Academy itself, is that social media is, you know, at least relative to the Oscars, is somewhat new in terms of campaigning. And there's still a lot of things that have not been regulated yet. And I think that's where we're seeing some of this ambiguity and some of these loopholes starting to open up. And I think that was something that that Riseborough's team and also Mary McCormick, as you mentioned, really were able to exploit. But, you know, I have heard other people in Hollywood. I know there was a an article about Christina Ricci who was talking about and saying somewhat similar things like, aren't the studios doing this already? But it's just, you know, it's from a smaller campaign, so it stands out more. So I don't know. I'm seeing within the industry itself like a lot more. I'm seeing some measured responses to this, which is actually refreshing. I guess the way I feel about it is I always thought of the Oscars as a game. So to me, this is like, if you're staying within the rules, then I think it's why not? Like, I certainly don't see the Oscars as an objective measure of what's best in cinema. And I would also say, just, you know, unlike, I'd say, like the three of us, like the Academy members are not watching, you know, all the movies that we do. So these movies really have to fight for oxygen. And you have to, you know, you have to choose to prioritize certain ones. And unfortunately, that means other ones get shut out. And I guess I just, you know, I think this has really revealed the whole system. And that's what the Academy doesn't like. And, you know, and I guess I understand it on a level.
Yeah, I think that that's probably the real motivation behind all of this. I think it's, you know, I really hope that they don't retract her nomination. I think that would suck because, like you said, Justin, like, as long as you're following the rules, then what's the problem? And these arguments of, well, it seems like they rode the line between whether they were following these rules technically or not. But none of the possible violations seem egregious in any way. So it would seem like such a radical step to retract a nomination that you would really want there to be a much clearer example of this was explicitly wrong and wrong in a very significant way, which I just don't think is true about the allegations, even if they are maybe technically incorrect on certain technical regulation requirements. But it is sort of weird because it's like, you know, I feel like a lot of people have framed this as like, well, it's like it's this nice grassroots movement to get this person that everybody watched their movie and really liked to get more attention. But what it actually is this, like, you know, an influence network of really important, powerful people in Hollywood getting behind this movie in a really concentrated way. That's not exactly an underdog story, right? That is, and we can see how that can really close people out. But then the alternative is, you know, having studios spending millions of dollars on campaigns, which is also not exactly an underdog story. So it feels like there's no real like virtuous figures in this argument at all. So what I hope more than anything is that this kind of pushes them to do more in terms of, revising the rules in the future and getting some reform in there, because the part that no one ever talks about when they complain about the $1 million Oscar campaigns is, well, what you said, Justin, which is this is a body of working people in Hollywood who for about a month and a half get, you know, hundreds of DVDs and screener links emailed to them and says, okay, watch all of these movies and then tell us who you think should win these awards. And obviously there needs to be some mechanism in place to try to get the best things in front of the most people. It can't just happen organically. But if that's the case, like, how do we do that in a more equitable way? And, you know, then we're just back into questions of structural biases and things like that, that, you know, haunt all of American society, film worlds, not at all free of that. So, Marissa, I'm going to give you the last word on this topic before we move on. Where are you feeling? Like, how would you feel if they actually retracted the nomination? Is there reforms that you think should be put in place in response to this moving forward?
Yeah, I think a retraction of the nomination would be total BS, honestly. I like, you know, they did it. Just let them do it. If they retracted it, it would be more of an expression of capitulation to larger studios who have to pay more money for these campaigns than anything, I would think. if there was an actual violation, I could see that. But if there's not a real violation and it just toes the line, I think it they got to just let it stand and really put down some reforms about campaigning in the future.
Is there any reform off the top of your head that you think the Oscar nomination process would really benefit from that isn't in place right now?
Oh, Christ. I don't know. You know, like Justin said, I mean, social media is this like hard to wrangle medium where things are shifting so constantly that it's hard to figure out rules to stop it, because realistically, you know, Twitter won't exist maybe in a year. So who can say? You can make rules to say don't tweet about competition, but then like, what if Twitter doesn't exist? Then what do you say about Instagram? I mean, there's just, or TikTok. I don't know. What possible campaign could you do on TikTok? I have no idea. I think it's impossible to wrangle. I don't know. I really don't know.
It's almost like you would need an ethics committee just for social media. Just to stay on top of that as their one job.
Yeah, with like just Gen Zers or something who actually understand what is going on and can be like, okay, here are the rules you should make. Because yeah, like what, these old farts from the Academy trying to figure out how to wrangle social media practices like and standards? No way. No way. They're going to just keep running into this problem.
I feel like this is the problem across all sectors of society these days. What do we do about social media? So Oscars are not immune from that problem. I don't know if they ever do an ethics board. I hope that Bette Midler gets to be in charge of it, because I think for better or worse, she's definitely more indicative of the average Academy voter on Twitter than we would probably like to admit. I don't know if you follow what she's up to, but it's great.
You're right. And it's terrifying that you're right. Honestly, what a horrific vision of the future you've created there, Alex.
Thank you. The greatest minds of our generation destroyed by Twitter. In any case, so that's going to do it for that discussion. Before we move on into our categories, I wanted to just briefly do a quick tour of the state of the acting races, because it's really notable. As I said earlier, this is a historic year for first-time nominees. 16 first-time Oscar nominees in the acting categories. First time that's happened in 86 years. So that's pretty impressive. The last time that 16 first-time acting nominees were nominated in one year, it was the year that Gary Cooper and Spencer Tracy both got their first nominations, to give it some perspective.
Oh, wow.
So a lot of new blood in these nominations. And I think it's really interesting to just like see what, to do a temperature check on what the actual races are, because it seems like some of these are well and truly wrapped up already, right? We have Angela Bassett, basically no challengers in supporting actress that I could see. You know, I think because Banshees seems to be doing really well in Hollywood, I feel like there's a chance that Carrie Condon could surprise, but it seems like Angela's got this in the bag, right? What do you guys think?
I don't know. I'm seeing like a lot more of a surge for Carrie recently. But, you know, I was happy to see Angela here, and I certainly think it would be kind of like a lifetime achievement award if she got it, long overdue, in my opinion. But I don't know. I guess I'm feeling like it's maybe a little bit closer than maybe you think, but I don't know. What do you think, Marissa?
I would be surprised if she didn't win it at this point, Bassett, simply because it really feels like the narrative is so solidified by this point. I mean, unless she wins or loses the SAG, I can't imagine someone else coming in. I really like the Condon performance. I think it's probably of that group my favorite supporting nomination, but I don't know. I think it would be really tough for Angela Bassett to lose, because at this point, this year feels like, in the acting categories at least, a year about lifetime achievement awards in a way, where like Angela Bassett is a great actress and should have an Oscar. It's absurd she doesn't have one. And the same is true for Michelle Yeoh. And I don't think that's a bad thing. Often the Oscars are about lifetime like awards. I mean, that's part of the Will Smith thing last year, was that this is a person who has been in the industry for a lot of years, done a lot of great work. Here is a role that is very, very strong. Let's give them an award. So I think it would be hard for Angela Bassett to not be, win here. But, you know, I love a surprise, but I think it would be, I don't know. I think it would leave a really bad taste in people's mouth for, you know, one of the few people of color, like, nominated to lose to a white person, to be brutally honest.
Yeah, I worry that over the course of the next, like, few weeks as people vote, that the whole she would be the first MCU actor to win an Oscar, like, I worry that that's going to creep in and get people to be like, oh, never mind, we don't want to do that.
If I were an Academy voter, that would make me automatically not vote for someone, brutally honest.
Exactly, right? Like, I mean, I don't, like, personally, I obviously am very invested in the MCU and a fan, but I definitely feel like that would leave a lot of bad taste in a lot of people's mouths to frame it in that way that I keep seeing on the internet. So I worry for her, but I do think that it's probably, if we had to say the race, it would be between her and Carrie, but it just seems like Carrie's still trailing pretty far relative to that. So it'll be interesting to see what happens. I will say, if Angela wins, I feel like that's the first time an Oscar win would be solidified on the San Diego Comic-Con stage, because it's when that trailer debuted for the first time and you got that monologue. That is definitely the reason why she's in there. So that would be an interesting footnote. speaking of Comic-Con participants, Ki-Hoo Kwan, who will be an MCU actor in the near future in Loki season 2, he seems to be running away with this as well. I thought that this race was going to be between him and Brandon Gleeson, but do you feel like that's the race, or do you think that the race is locked up at this point, Justin?
I'm thinking Kwan at this point. You know, I just think it's such a good narrative behind it. I mean, I've every article I've ever seen about him has been about how he, you know, quit acting because he wasn't finding the roles that he thought he deserved, and then, like, came back and is like, won a nomination, and, like, what a great story that would be. What a great, you know, narrative for the Academy to tell themselves, like, oh, we did that. So I don't know. I just see it really moving in his direction.
What do you think, Marissa?
Yeah, I think that's 100% right. I mean, like, the Golden Globes, in my mind, are this sort of, like, big stop on the way to campaigning for your Oscar. And that speech was so good that I can't imagine, you know, that not being, like, who wouldn't vote for this person? He's so charming. He's been so good. And the narrative is unbeatable. And, you know, who doesn't love a good narrative when it comes to these voting?
Yeah, it's an ex. I mean, this is literally his first acting role back from after, like, in that story too, which is just wild to think about. That, you know, he left Hollywood, became like an assistant director, things like that, and then he tells this story about how he watched Crazy Rich Asians and he thought, oh, maybe things are changing now. Maybe I can get back in this. I want to be a part of this. And then, like, he hires an agent, and within a few weeks, he gets this opportunity. And, you know, I mean, he had to, and he also still had to work for it. He had to audition, and he had to wait a long time. So it has that sort of thing that I think appeals to a lot of people in Hollywood, the sort of, you know, like, Cinderella story of a comeback that is so richly deserved based on not just the performance, but also this man who seems like a genuinely nice person, and who is so good at telling that story. I've seen him tell that story on the Golden Globe stage and in a variety of different, you know, interviews, and I'm sure he's doing it at live events, and he's really got it down, and he's always very charming and likable, and just seems so happy to be there, and people like to vote for people like that. So I'd be very surprised if it doesn't happen. Now, a more complicated race is the Best Actor race, which for a long time had been, you know, Brendan Fraser, Colin Farrell, with Austin Butler bringing up the rear. And I'm curious, Marissa, do you think that that's still the race? Do you think that this is a three-man race still, or do you think that, you know, Fraser, with The Whale losing the Best Picture nomination and the Best Adapted Screenplay nomination, is maybe not as strong as people thought, and maybe he's actually not even in the race anymore?
I mean, frankly, the choice between those three, for me, it's like Sophie's choice, honestly. I like one of those performances, to be brutally honest. And unfortunately, I think Butler will win, you know, I mean, I guess he deserves it for selling his soul, but I don't know. Like, I think the actor race is a total bomb this year, honestly. I mean, like, if anybody has ever listened to any Oscar podcast I've ever been on, I don't care about actors anyway, but boy, do I not care about this one. You know, I'd love it if Colin Farrell won. I would love for anyone to beat Austin Butler, frankly, even if it has to be Brendan Fraser. You know, I believe in the Renaissance. The Mummy 1999 is, like, frankly, a formative film in my catalog. So, you know, I don't think that movie's very good. I mean, it's like actively fatphobic, but, you know, it's all bad, in my opinion, unless Colin Farrell wins, who, you know, that would be nice. I like Colin Farrell and he's good in that movie.
He's so good in that movie. Yeah, and he's just like, he's gone from like Hollywood badass to like just like a sweet man who just comes off so charming and like thoughtful, and it's just like, it's really wild to see the transformation in his public image. But I mean, I'm rooting for him for sure in that respect.
Yeah, I mean, but I remember, you know, back when he was playing Bullseye in 2003's unsung masterpiece Daredevil. So, you know, what an arc. Again, narrative, a great narrative. I would love it. Like, Austin Butler, like, okay, who are you, honestly? Like, you came from the Disney Channel or whatever, and like, now you're just here, you know, the reanimated, like, puppet soul of Elvis. I don't really get it, honestly. He is very charming in interviews, though. I mean, women are just like throwing themselves off, you know, onto the stage, basically. So good for him, I guess.
Well, and he would be the fifth youngest best lead actor winner ever, which is really notable because, you know, this is a category unlike best lead actress, which oftentimes goes with an ingenue. This is a category where Hollywood is typically pretty gatekeepy. And, you know, like, we've had young actors in the past kind of try to break through and fail, like, you know, Leonardo DiCaprio and Timothée Chalamet and like so many others in the past. And like, we even think about like, oh, well, you know, like, there's been younger actors who have won recently, like, you know, our Bohemian Rhapsody friend who should go unnamed, in my opinion. But even he was like 38 when he got it. So this would be a really young, would be, you know, right along with like Eddie Redmayne as a rare exception to the rule. And, you know, Eddie Redmayne had to be just absurdly charming, and he was for like a solid 9 months that year. So Butler is definitely following those footsteps, so it could definitely happen. But I'm really curious, Justin, do you think that Fraser is still part of this conversation, or do you think that it's Butler and Farrell now?
You know, well, I kind of have, I guess I'm wondering, do you want me to save this, because I had this category as part of my bold prediction. But yeah, although the way that you're framing it is making me rethink whether it actually is a bold prediction, so
yeah, okay, well then we'll table that for now. The last acting race that is available to us is, I was gonna say notable, but it's literally the only other one that we have, is the Cate Blanchett versus Michelle Yeoh best actress race. And I think, like, everyone, this has been the race for the entire season. Another two MCU alums in this respect as well. I feel like we need to normalize the fact that all of these actors have been in Marvel movies to help get Angela Bassett over the hump, in my opinion. So I'm just trying to push that as a narrative. But yeah, so that's the race. I mean, do you think that there's any chance that anybody else comes in and overcomes the Cate and Michelle of it all, Marissa?
I mean, the chaos monster in me would like laugh so hard if Andrea Riseborough won, but I don't know. I don't think so. I think it is a two woman race at this point. I'm pulling for Michelle Yeoh, but like, I could easily see Cate Blanchett winning, honestly, because I feel like every 5 years she gives the best performance of her career, and she is unbelievable in Tar. I mean, really.
Yeah.
If she didn't already have a couple, I think there'd be no contest. But yeah, I don't think anyone could do it. I mean, the only one I think could do it would be Andrea Riseborough, just for, you know, she played the numbers game. Who knows what could have happened, you know? I don't know how far they moneyballed this moneyball.
it would be kind of wild if Ana de Armas won for playing Marilyn Monroe and beat Michelle Christ. Williams, who has also played Marilyn Monroe and been nominated for it in the past. That would be a wild turn of events.
That's a good point. You know, I'm going to have to compare because I quite liked Michelle as Marilyn. I mean, she looks nothing like her, and, you know, but there was a certain, I don't know, she's just a very good actress. You know what I mean?
Yeah, absolutely. Justin, what do you think? Any chance that, you know, one of these other lovely women surpass the Kate versus Michelle of it all?
I don't think so. I mean, and I'd also say, like, it just seems to be trending more in Michelle Yeoh's favor recently, which makes me think that a vote split is maybe not as much of a possibility. You know, and I think, like you said, Marissa, like, Kate's won before. She's won twice before, once as leading and once as supporting. And I think there's a lot of love for this performance, but I don't know. I also could see it being very divisive, especially given the content of the film. I just think that there's more of a push behind Michelle Yeoh. So I just don't really see, I certainly don't see anyone else being part of the conversation. And I am thinking, yeah, at this point.
Yeah, there's a famous movie tagline for Alien versus Predator, where they said, whoever wins, we lose. And I think in this instance of Kate versus Michelle, it's the opposite, because they're two fantastic performances, maybe the two best performances of the year. So whoever wins, we win, which is a rare situation in Oscar races, in my opinion. So I'm happy to say that. But now, from the Oscars categories to our own categories, we're going to move on to our little rundown of our pleasant surprises and snubs and best picture predictions and, of course, bold predictions. So we're going to get straight into pleasant surprises, starting on an optimistic note. Noah was nice enough to send in his picks for these while on vacation. So I'm going to be reading his choice before we begin each of the categories. And for a pleasant surprise, he went with Stephanie Hsu, getting a Best Supporting Actress nomination in Everything Everywhere All at Once. He listed this because he said that he was worried that she was going to be overshadowed by her co-stars in this film, at least in the Academy's eyes, even though he personally really loved her performance. So he was really excited to see her get that nomination. Marissa, how about you? What's a pleasant surprise that came across Oscar nomination morning?
Mrs. Harris Goes to Paris getting nominated for costuming. What a delight. That was actually officially the last movie I watched of 2022. And the costumes are wonderful. You know, I was on a plane watching it, which is like some films are made to be watched on a plane when you're like a little loopy from the altitude and in a nice mood and like in a prime mood to cry.
Sure.
And that was perfect. And yeah, I loved that movie, and the costuming is wonderful. So I was really happy about that.
It's a very sweet movie, and the costumes play a big role. I mean, the whole thing is about buying a dress and making a dress. So I love that that impressed costume designers enough to nominate it.
And it's Jenny Beavan, who is a longtime nominee and winner. So it totally made sense when I saw who the costume designer was. But yeah, it was really nice to see it.
I love that movie. I feel like it lived up to the expectations of a movie named Mrs. Harris Goes to Paris. It was everything you could have wanted. So very happy about that. Justin, how about you? What was your pleasant surprise?
For me, the pleasant surprise were all the Below the Line nominations for Tar, which is currently my favorite movie of last year. Obviously, Cate Blanchett was a given, I think, from the word go. But to see it in directing, see it in film editing, see it in cinematography, I mean, those were definitely more of a surprise to me. I really like, you know, and I think it is obviously being, you know, a favorite movie of mine. I think it absolutely deserves them. I think the cinematography is really dynamic. I love how it changes based on the setting or mood. I mean, I think of like all the like there's like a scene on stage when let's just say Cate Blanchett's character is not supposed to be there at that time, and I love that it switches to like handheld for that. It just really makes that moment so much more visceral. And I just, you know, I think through the editing, the pacing really starts to pick up as we hurtle toward the inevitable conclusion. So I just think it's really those elements are deserving because they're really working toward telling the story. And I just was like very surprised to see that, because I tend to think of cinematography, at least in terms of the Oscars, as being very You know, there's no like really grand vistas or anything in this. I mean, there's a few, you know, there's a few exteriors, but like nothing on the level of, you know, like a Lawrence of Arabia or anything like that. And also like in terms of the editing, it's not really an action movie, even though, you know, Banshees did get a nomination here as well. But traditionally, films like Tar don't usually get noticed here. And that was, so for me, that was, I was really happy to see that. And just, you know, for the directing, obviously, I think it's incredibly well directed. I was certainly thinking with the five slots that this movie, would not necessarily get in there for that. And I guess maybe the surprise of it is I just worried that this movie was going to get noted mostly for its lead performance and not really for anything else. And again, I would say that from the beginning, and to see that it actually did have some life and that it did get some recognition for the other things that make it great was very satisfying for me.
Yeah, Todd Field now 3 for 3 in terms of the fact that he has written 3 screenplays and all 3 of them have been nominated for Oscars, which is quite the achievement. But yeah, very, very happy to see that it got a robust showing, because it is one of my favorite films of the year. I think it's just like one of those like incredibly well-crafted films from top to bottom. So it's nice when those actually get respected in the award season. But for me, my pleasant surprise is actually not about Tar. It's about Women Talking getting Best Picture nomination. I was really hoping for this throughout the season, especially given the other potential nominees that were favored to get ahead of it at various points, specifically The Whale. I think by after that PGA rundown, a lot of people thought, well, The Whale's going to get it over Women Talking. And that was an outcome that I just didn't want to see. So I was very happy to see Women Talking getting in there. I was rooting for it even before I saw it. And then I saw it and it blew me away far more than I was anticipating. So now I'm even a bigger fan of its awards chances. And I'm very glad that, especially given the fact that it was not able to get any acting nominations, which I do understand because it's such a powerful ensemble. And it's really hard to identify like a specific actor that you want to single out in terms of acting achievement. So for me, Best Picture is kind of a tribute to that ensemble in addition to the great work that Sarah Polley did in directing and writing it. So I was very, very happy to see that end up coming out. Although I will say, you know, the AARP Movies for Grownups Awards just awarded Judith Ivey their Best Supporting Actress Award. And that was very exciting for Judith Ivey for Women Talking. So I was happy to see at least one body of awards voters that we can respect, the Movies for Grownups Awards, wanted to recognize an actor from this incredible ensemble.
Yeah, wow, that's not the person I would have thought they would. Well, you know, not that she isn't great in the movie, but it's tough to really, like you said, it's tough to single anyone out. But I'm surprised they went with that person, to be honest.
Yeah, Movies for Grownups, they will always surprise you. Like when they also this year gave Best Grown-Up Love Story to Good Luck to You, Leo Grand, which is a movie that is explicitly not a love story in any way. So wild choices by them. but that's our pleasant surprises. Now we're going to move on to our snubs, which is the thing I think, you know, the internet loves to talk the most about when it comes to Oscar nominations. Noah went with The Woman King, which we didn't talk about in our earlier segment because I thought it might definitely pop up here. But he was particularly upset to see them miss in technical categories like costume design and production design. He thought that obviously Viola Davis and Miss Lynch should have been getting lead and supporting actor nominations, but he thought that they would at least as a film get costume design and production design, and they failed to even do that. They truly were have graduated to the This Had Oscar Buzz cemetery, unfortunately. So Marissa, what was a snub that spoke to you?
Dolly De Leon not getting nominated for supporting in Triangle of Sadness. I probably like that movie a little more than Justin, it seems like, but you know, I think that was such an incredible performance from someone who has not had you know, much of an American career, realistically, at least one that like has been in this sort of echelon of acting. And I think that whole movie hinges on how good that performance is. So I would have loved to seen her be nominated, especially as like, again, the sort of Filipino connection of like, I would just love to have seen it. Cause I really think it was one of the like performances I'll remember from this year. Like in the long run, how many of these will I actually think about going forward? That one, certainly. I think the two for me are that one and then Danielle Deadwyler and Till. I mean, realistically, like I said before, I think Till should be in like pretty much every category, like directing, picture, actress, costuming, cinematography. I would put it everywhere. So yeah, those are my two sort of big disappointments.
Yeah. Now I unfortunately haven't seen Till yet, but I know Justin has, and he's a pretty big fan of it too. So is do you echo Marissa's discontentment over Till missing in so many categories?
Yes, absolutely. And again, this was a case where I agree with you, Marissa. I think it has a lot more going for it than just the lead performance. But to me, that seemed like, especially having seen the movie, that seemed to me like, oh, that's a given. Like, you can't deny that performance. Like, there's just, and it seemed like the kind of thing where I'm like, oh, this is like everything that Oscar loves too. So it's got that going for it. And evidently not. So I will just also, not being especially big fan of Triangle of Sadness, I will say Dolly De Leon was one of the big high points for me. So yeah, it would have been nice. I feel like I would, in my opinion, I would like maybe take away all the other nominations and give her the nomination so that Triangle of Sadness could be represented that way. But yeah, and you want to talk about memorable, like there's like the last few shots of her in the movie. Oh my gosh. just really blew me away. So yeah, you want to just talk about acting just through physicality. Wow.
But so what's your, is the Till snub, is that your selection for biggest snub of the morning?
It's not the one that I picked. I will echo what Noah said about Woman King. It was like a huge surprise when he got just blanked. And like you said, Alex, this had Oscar buzz, which is not where I thought that was going. I tried to go with something maybe a little less obvious, and my snub is Nope for visual effects, which of course I have talked about many times on our podcast, even outside of our full episode on it. But this was a pretty crowded field, to be fair. However, I think there was a slot that this could have filled. I think this could have filled the Black Panther Wakanda Forever slot, in my opinion. As a fan of that movie, I don't know if I would say the visual effects were the best part of it for me. And I think what they managed to do with the special effects in Nope really feel like a game changer. I think it's, you've got genuine moments of awe in the special effects, whether it's every form of the creature that is named Jean Jacket to the view from inside its gullet at one point, multiple points, I should say. All that looks like something I'm not quite sure how they did. And I think you add to that the fact that the sky is CGI the whole time, which I only learned in the past few days. They had to really apply filters to achieve the look that Jordan Peele wanted. And that's one of those things that's not as obvious when it comes to CGI, but is essential to making the movie work. So I just think those things combined make it, to me, something that should have been a shoe-in for this category. And, you know, a film that I could see being very polarizing to people, but I thought at least with visual effects, what this film was able to achieve, I just thought it would at least get a slot here, at least a nomination. And the fact that it didn't, I think, is a real travesty.
Yeah, it's crazy that Nope just missed across the board. You know, that seemed like a movie that I thought was going to be much more widely appreciated than Us, which was very polarizing in ways that I understood. But it turned out that Nope was also polarizing in ways that that I guess I should have seen coming. So it'll be interesting to see. You know, you think that Jordan Peele is part of the club because he made big with Get Out, in a movie that was not necessarily a traditional Oscar film. He keeps making those movies and Oscars seems to have lost interest. So, I mean, but, you know, he's making great films, so who cares, I guess. But yeah, I agree. There's definitely room in the visual effects category for Nope at the very least. you know, I'm also seeing like the Batman getting visual effects kind of strange, because they don't really, that's not what you think of when you think of that movie. Not that that has bad visual effects, but, you know, it's pretty incidental to what's going on in that movie. That movie's so grounded and, you know, unless I guess they're getting credit for the rain, in which case then job well done. But so now we're going to move on to our next category, which is where we guess best picture. Now, this historically doesn't go well for us, because as we learn, it's oftentimes very hard, despite the fact that once Oscar comes around, it feels like, well, best picture is usually a foregone conclusion. We always forget that this many weeks out, it's still an open race. And obviously, Coda took us all by surprise. Noah has decided this year that he is going to choose one of the front runners of the race and put his lock in with Everything Everywhere All at Once. And he has also promised us that he will not watch the ceremony, because longtime listeners know that when he chooses to wake up early and watch the ceremony in Germany, it never goes well. And most of the time when he sleeps through it, it does. So we'll see if that superstition pans out. Marissa, what are you going with for Best Picture? Are you gonna go with? Well, I'm gonna say first, I'm going with Everything Everywhere All at Once as well. I'm going along with Noah. You know, I would be very happy if Banshees won. That is also a very good film. But Everything Everywhere All at Once is my favorite film of the year, and maybe my favorite film of the last 5 years. And I have to vote with my heart, even though the tradition of Oscar movie with most nominations and is the front runner going into the nomination morning, that tends to not work out for that film. People tend to get a little bit tired of that movie by the time the voting comes around. But I'm still going to go vote with my heart. Marissa, how about you?
Yeah, I mean, I think Everything Everywhere All at Once is a pretty safe option at this point, because, I mean, listen, ranked choice voting is hard to predict. You have to just guess what's going to get the most number ones and then what's going to get the most number twos and threes after that. And I think that's the kind of movie that's going to rank high enough on everybody's list that if it doesn't win it outright, it'll be in the top two or three.
Yeah, it has that sort of thing that, you know, Coda had last year, and a number of films that have won Best Picture in the past or recently has, which is, it is a, like, it's an accessible film. It's a funny film. It's an emotionally, you know, satisfying movie. And it also has that level of kind of, you know, added of prestige based on how it's been responded to. So I think that it has the thing that can get it in and get it across the finish line. But I also feel like it's kind of insane that we're even having this conversation, because when I watched this in April, I was like, well, that's my favorite movie, and there's just no possible way it's going to get a single Oscar nomination, because, you know, I mean, there's scenes where people, you know, shove phallic objects up their butts in order to multiversal travel through dimensions or whatever. Like, that, there's no way the Oscars could go for this weird fucking movie. But they are so far. So I'm like, just let's ride it out. Justin, do you agree?
Yeah, actually, I hate to be boring, but yeah, this is what I had as well. I think it just, you know, I don't know if I mentioned this phrase yet, but I feel like I'm going to be saying it a lot. It just seems to be winning like the charm competition in terms of the actual like tours, the meet and greets, the interviews. I think it really helps, like, as much as the entire cast is certainly responsible for that. I think it helps having an old Hollywood stalwart like Jamie Lee Curtis also behind this. And I think that's also helping maybe push it ahead with some of the older voters. And yeah, it is insane to think that a movie like this could win Best Picture, not just because of some of the subject matter that you mentioned, Alex, but in terms of its just ambition and what it's willing to do, the fact that it can be, you know, it's a heavily like action, like there's a ton of action, like martial arts, and then a lot of, you know, philosophical, you know, musing in the midst of that, all coming together. I also just think this would be a good story. Again, it's also about a narrative. I think it would be a good story for the Academy to have a winner like this that does have a little more diversity than we've seen. I just wonder, you know, just given everything that seems to be working for it, And in terms of the goodwill that it seems to be getting, I just think that it's going to be tough to beat. At the same time, I'm with you, Alex. I would not mind if Banshees won. That's also one of my favorite films of the year, which, boy, is it good to say that a McDonough film is, actually good. So it's actually deserving of some of these things. Boy, that's satisfying. especially
yeah, he really took the note on Three Billboards and swerved in the correct direction, which is really nice to see. I feel like that doesn't happen often.
Going back to a project, I've mentioned this before, going back to a project that he at one point said wasn't any good and managing to make one of the best films of the year out of that. So take that as you will. But yeah, I'm going Everything Everywhere. I'd be, even happier if that won. We'll see what happens in the next, month and change. But I just think Everything Everywhere is the one to beat.
Now, that is our Best Picture discussion, which means that we only have one more category left before we close it out for this year. And that is our bold predictions. Now, we like to just kind of shoot our shot and think of one thing that might be kind of unconventional or seem like a long shot and declare that that's what's going to happen. And then we never bring it up again, just out of respect for our courage, unless it works out, which I don't think it ever has. But I'm going to tell you that Noah's pick for a bold prediction is that Everything Everywhere All at Once is going to win the most Oscars. Now, of course, it has the best chance of winning the most Oscars because it was nominated for the most Oscars. But people who study these things will note that oftentimes the nominee that the film that has the most nominations turns out to, ironically, very rarely end up with the most wins. By the time it comes around to the Oscar night. So Noah is going out on a limb and saying Everything Everywhere All at Once is going to clean up at the Oscars and win the most awards of the night. Justin, I'm going to bring it right back to you. What do you think your bold prediction? You teased it a little earlier in the conversation.
Yeah, hopefully it's not anticlimactic because I was looking at the best Oscar race, best actor race, and it really seemed like there was still a lot of steam behind Brendan Fraser and Austin Butler. And I just think that Colin Farrell's, at least at this point, I feel like he might have a shot here. And again, I'm kind of basing this on partially basing it on the character he plays, who is very lovable despite doing some, despicable things. And just his persona, which I think you've alluded to, Alex, like off screen, he's very affable. He's very charming. He has this like sweetness to him. I just think that's going to go a long way especially in the next month or so. And I just wonder if this is maybe just, some controversy around The Whale. It seems to be like, even if there is, it's maybe going to be, if any category, it's not going to rub off on it, might be the best actor one. But I just wonder if that's going to be on the voters' minds. And Austin Butler looks really, he does look like a very strong contender here. He may even be the one, but he is younger. I am taking that into account. There may be other chances to award him at some point, although he is playing Elvis, so I'm mindful of that. But at the same time, I think it's going to be maybe a bit of a charm competition. I just wonder if someone who's a little bit older might have a slight edge in that. And then the last thing I'll say for this, for whatever this is worth, is this is currently Anne Thompson of IndieWire, her prediction for 2023 in terms of best actor. She's a critic for IndieWire. And on Gold Derby, she was the one who did the best job of predicting the 2023 nominees. So she has a really good track record for this kind of stuff. So she also agrees with me that it's going to go to Farrell. So add a little bit of a cheering section for me. So.
Well, I would love to see that happen. He's one of my favorite performances of the year, and he also gave three very distinct performances in this calendar year that I always love to reward someone who has that extra credit to them, because of course, he also was a fantastic lead performer in a different kind of mode in After Yang, and then gave a scene-stealing performance as the Penguin in The Batman, which is really notable. So yeah, I'd be very, very happy to see that. I think I've been really a huge fan of his career for the last decade, basically, the choices that he's made. And it's about time that he gets rewarded. But you know, Austin Butler are also really, really good in that movie. I feel like I have to say this now because I haven't said it before and you guys are not fans of him, and at least as much, and I could respect that. But I think that the fact that he was asked to be Elvis, and then like he kind of like sells those scenes where, and Elvis is like one of the most iconic people when it comes to, you know, like charisma and stage presence, and like this is a kid who is not, I mean, kid, he's like my age, but you know somebody who does not have that baggage in terms of being known for that sort of thing. And yet he comes out there and he embodies him in a way that is really transfixing. And say what you will about the rest of the film, I think that the movie doesn't work at all if that doesn't work. And I think we were all shocked when he was announced as being Elvis many years ago. And so the fact that he nailed it as hard as he did, I think is respectable, if nothing else. And yeah, it seems to have literally broken his brain, and like he no longer can speak with his own native accent anymore. And that's certainly something. So I'm very interested to see where that goes. But I'm not going to pick Austin Butler for my bold prediction. Instead, I'm going to pick somebody who I don't even know if this should qualify as a bold prediction, because in some senses it's like the favorite, but it's also feels kind of strange in a way, because I'm talking about in Best Director Steven Spielberg, because it seems like he is kind of considered the favorite of this category. But at the same time, Best Director doesn't always go to the winner of Best Picture, but it always goes to one of the top contenders for Best Picture, if nothing else. And it definitely seems like The Fabelmans has run out of steam in that respect and really doesn't have any real chance to win Best Picture. But, you know, the Spielberg narrative still seems strong enough to possibly carry him through. If history would dictate anything, you would suggest that, you know, the Daniels or Martin McDonagh would end up winning because they have the two strongest cases for Best Picture as well. But I really think Steven Spielberg is going to get his third Best Director win after, you know, Saving Private Ryan and Schindler's List in the 90s for this film that is kind of just like his grand, you know, statement about his life and the power of filmmaking and all of the rest. He's notably with this nomination tied for second on the all-time list of person most nominated for Best Director. He's tied second with Martin Scorsese, who may be getting nominated again next year. We'll have to see. And he's also tied for first with Billy Wilder for a person who has directed the most Best Picture nominees at 13, which is a pretty interesting stat as well. So I don't know. This just kind of feels like the last time they're going to get a real chance to award him Best Director. And I think he definitely deserves to be in the company of people who have won three Best Director awards. But Marissa, I wanted to leave you for last because you are our honored guest. So can you close things out for us with your bold prediction?
I think I'm going to go for sort of like a, I don't know, less like you guys are picking big stuff. I kind of think this is just like maybe a me thing, but I think All Quiet is going to get shut out, honestly. I think it's clearly well-liked, but I think it might be one of those movies that everybody seems to like it, but nobody will put first on their list when it comes to actually voting for something. Or the opposite could happen and it wins everything and then it wins Best Picture. But I think it's going to get shut out.
Yeah, I could definitely see that happening. I mean, it definitely doesn't seem like it's the favorite in any category that it's nominated in. So that would be crazy if it ended up getting none while unexpectedly racking up 10 nominees over the course of the night. So interesting to see. Definitely that adapted screenplay nomination could be, that seems like a category that's pretty winnable, but you know, you got Sarah Polley, who I'm rooting for in that. So, and then of course, Top Gun Maverick, which we didn't really even talk about, but Top Gun Maverick getting screenplay was a real surprise for a lot of people, understandably. Yeah. So.
Yeah. So, well, and even Ryan Johnson is in that category for Glass Onion. If like, I think that's a solid possibility too. So yeah, I just think it's going to get shut out. I really do. Cause it's like, you're right. Every category has something a little stronger that I think has maybe, you know, more of a chance than it.
Yeah. I guess like, do you think that, well, what do you think is going to win Best International?
I mean, that might win it, but of the ones I've seen so far, I don't know. I wonder how many people have seen Close at this point. Cause I thought Close was really, really good. So I mean, I can't say for sure without seeing the rest of them, but that just came out. And yeah, I mean, I guess, like, you know, Oscar voters have maybe already seen it, or maybe they're just getting screeners now. I'm not exactly sure, but I don't know. I think, yeah, maybe that's its best option, but I'd love to see anything else win, sort of. I don't know. I think it's good. I just don't think it's as good as some of the other stuff.
Yeah. Well, I'm rooting for you to be right on that one, because I don't want to watch that movie, because it's like a epic war movie about World War One. I feel like we've done that a number of times in the past, so I don't know if I need to see this one. But if it wins a bunch of Oscars, I'll feel compelled to at least give it a chance. So I hope you're right, Marissa, so I could feel a little bit better about not watching it. Although if EO beats it in international features, I will have some words that I'll have to declare someplace, because, oh boy.
I'm with you on that. I think I wouldn't be happy about that, if I'm brutally honest. You know, I'm rooting for Close at the moment. And I hear The Quiet Girl's good.
Everyone who I know, very few people have seen it, but every time somebody watches it on Letterboxd, the response is always, wow, this was great. So I'm looking forward to catching up on it eventually. A rare international feature nominee for Ireland. So it was pretty cool to see. But so that's going to do it for us, guys. We went on for longer than I think we anticipated, as is our want. I think that overall, feeling pretty good about our situation, Oscars, and can't wait to see all of our hopes and dreams turn to ash as we watch the telecast in a couple of weeks' time. But in the meantime, Marissa, you're our guest, so please let us know where our audience can find more of your work on, you know, the internets.
Yeah, I am occasionally writing reviews on thepopbreak.com. I recently panned Infinity Pool, basically. Hopefully I'll be seeing more stuff soon. I might review The Quiet Girl, actually. And otherwise, you can catch me on most social media except for Twitter at this point. At Marissa Carpico. Keep an eye on my Letterboxd and to see what random movie I'm obsessed with currently.
Awesome. And now, are you, with your co-host Matt Taylor, friend of the show, going to be putting out a bunch of Oscar category related podcasts over the next few weeks?
Yes, that is a good thing to mention. We should be having every year we do individual category episodes. Sometimes we actually do like an episode for each category, and sometimes we double stack just for convenience of recording. We'll probably start releasing those about 2 weeks before the ceremony. We have to see a lot of stuff first. I mean, this is like a record year for me. I had like 17 movies to watch once the nominations came out, not including the shorts category. So there's a heavier lift with watching than there usually is. Look for those. And then after that, we'll have a new season of our older Oscar podcast, which is, and the winner still is, doing a retrospective of past years of Oscar winners. So take a look at those in the next couple months.
For our listeners, do you want to tease some of the years you'll be covering on that podcast?
Yes, the year that Angela Bassett could have won an Oscar for playing Tina Turner in What's Love Got to Do With It. We're doing 1957, which is Bridge on the River Kwai. Let's see what else. We're also doing the year that Avatar was nominated, the first Avatar, sort of in anticipation of this year's Avatar. I think we recorded that before a new Avatar came out, so I think we were more excited about it than it actually ended up being about new Avatar. But it's a tour of very random years, it's filled with our usual chaos, so check it out.
Well, that's excellent. Justin and I have both been guests on that podcast in the past, so I always look forward to seeing what year you're covering and what you guys have to say about those years in retrospect. So keep up the good work on that one, Marissa. Justin, where can we find more of your stuff on the internet?
You can find me at thecinemaverick.com. I'm also on Letterboxd at thecinemaverick. I will say, for my website, you can now actually see my best of 2021 list. Yes, that's 2021. That's how far behind I am. But you can find that, and always takes me a while to do, but I usually end up being very proud of it. So please take a look. You can see, take a trip down memory lane and see what really moved me in 2021. So yeah.
Yes. Oh, and spoiler alert. Yeah. A lot of quiet. A lot of quiet, European set character dramas on that list.
yeah.
Which we love. So you know.
Mm-hmm. Also just plug my podcast, which you mentioned, Alex, Podwork Angels, The Rush Hour, which is part of Pop Break Today. It's a podcast dedicated to the rock band Rush. We go through every single one of their studio albums and talk about stuff that we like and stuff we don't. And it's a lot of fun. So check us out there.
Yes. And Noah is, of course, on that with you. Yes, so you can check out his stuff over there. And mm-hmm. also check out his blog, francenoir.blogspot.com. As for me, you can follow me on, you can follow all of my plugs on Twitter at Media Thinkings. I don't really post that much these days other than links to what I'm up to. So that's a good place to go to get a collection of those things. You can follow my film account on at Media Thinkings on Letterboxd, where you can see all the movies that I've been watching recently. There was a lot over the last couple of months, so you can catch up on that. I have been podcasting a lot the last month or so. So there's a lot of places you could see me, including TV Break Podcast, which is a podcast that I do with Bill Bodkin and Josh Chernacki about the world of television. We reviewed Rian Johnson's Case of the Week murder mystery series Poker Face, starring Natasha Lyonne for Peacock. That was a really fun discussion. Over on Bill versus the MCU, we are now covering the Defenders saga with recent episodes on Daredevil season one and Jessica Jones season one, where we discuss those old seasons of television, but also get some guests on to discuss kind of in hindsight how they're feeling about those television shows and what they want for the future of those characters moving into the MCU. I also had the pleasure of guesting on a number of podcasts over the last month or so, including the Piecing It Together podcast, where we discussed White Noise, the Anniversary Brothers podcast, where we celebrated the 15th anniversary of Breaking Bad, the Not Couple Goals podcast, where we discussed Cruel Intentions, and the Superhero Cinephiles podcast, where we discussed Spider-Man Homecoming. So you definitely follow me all of those places if you are not tired of listening to me talk by now. In the meantime, thank you so much for listening to this episode. Stay tuned next month for our 6th anniversary special, which will feature several special guests and a major announcement about the show. And until then, you can follow us on Twitter at CineJoes and subscribe to us on all major podcast platforms. Thanks again, Marissa, for coming on. This has been a blast. We always love to do this with you. And until next time, I've been Alex Marcus, and this has been CineJoes.